Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for April 14th, 2024. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Atlanta.
And welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
All right, excited about the show tonight. We're going to have on the show, old friend of the show who's been on here at least two other occasions in the past year or so, Milan Singh is going to come on the show. He is in with a different group called Blueprint 2024. They've been doing a ton of research, and Milan's going to join the show and tell us about their work, and we're going to talk about all kind of, you know, different findings they have. That'll come up in about 20 minutes. But until then, we've got a variety of topics to talk about. One topic, which sadly we did not have planned even, I'd say, 36 hours ago, you know, when the weekend started. But sadly, it was thwarted, but there was another escalation in the Middle East where Iran launched missiles against Israel. Fortunately, I think the overwhelming majority, I think it's in the high 90% of them, were somehow shot down by drones. So the loss of life and structure and all was kept pretty low. Tim, you were the first one to kind of alert us about this. I'll be honest, I was at the Dogwood Festival enjoying my Saturday when you said we need to switch up probably something on the show and mention this. Tell us what you saw. I guess it was happening yesterday afternoon.
Yeah, we apparently, the Iranians had telegraphed that they were going to do this so that our government and the president warned Israel that an attack against Israel itself of some sort was imminent. And we, of course, were watching it closely. We detected the launch of multiple missiles and all kind of stuff coming toward Israel. The Iranians were in a position, I guess, that they felt they were forced into some sort of action because of the attack against their consulate in Syria back on April the 1st, and where several of their senior military commanders was killed. That was a curious situation in itself because countries don't normally attack embassies. Those are considered to be off limits. So anyway, the Iranians felt they couldn't just sit there and do nothing unless they looked too weak to both their allies and adversaries. So they chose a curious path too. Normally, response to attacks is what, proportional? Is that a good word? This one, consisting of over 300 drones and ballistic missiles launched directly from Iran at Israel itself, is really beyond that. And I guess, guys, the question is, now what? Will this escalate both us and the British assisted Israel in repelling the attack? As you mentioned, David, about all of it was shot down. Will we be drawn into a wider war? We've told Israel will not engage in offensive operations against Iran. So Iran has said this, what happened last night is pretty much it for them if Israel doesn't respond. But you know that hardliners are in control over there, and I'll let y'all deal with that bit of wisdom.
Well, thanks. Catherine, Tim said, now what's next? It seems like, you know, the Jewish people had no homeland. We created a homeland in roughly 1948, and since then, it's just started. It's kind of like Billy Joel's song, We Didn't Start the Fire. It just continues on, and there's, you know, seemingly no peaceful end in sight.
Yeah, it's just the whole thing is so heartbreaking. And the leaders who are controlling the bombs and the military seem to have little concern for the citizens who are being injured or killed and the, you know, infrastructure that's being destroyed. It's just, you know, yeah, what's next? You know, so Iran says they won't respond if Israel doesn't respond, but how long can we think Israel will resist? Who knows? It's just heartbreaking.
Or Iran, if you keep with their word. I mean, it works both ways,
right,
on this. And
exactly,
what is heartening and sad about this is you actually hear stories of people that are very devout Jewish practitioners of the faith, usually, you know, clerics and whatnot. You hear about then they have friends that are devout practitioners of Islam, and you hear that people that are deeply tied to the Islamic and Judaism faith can be friends and get along and do things on a microcosm, whether it be in the Middle East or elsewhere, but within, you know, world geopolitics in the Middle East, that doesn't happen, you know, on that big level. Tim, if you want to kind of have, I guess, the wrap-up final word on this, because we are not foreign policy experts, and even foreign policy experts probably get, you know, vexed by this one.
Well, you know, they've been doing this tit-for-tat attack against each other for years, not directly at each other's country, though. I think Israel made a mistake by choosing an embassy for their attack. Good riddance to the guys they killed. They deserved it. But normally you choose some for other than an embassy, because an embassy is considered to be part of the actual country that occupies the embassy, no matter where it is. And Iran made a mistake by escalating. And they also threw Netanyahu a lifeline, changing the narrative from Gaza over now to people are looking at these people are attacking Israel because they don't even want Israel to exist, which is, in Iran's case, true. And it changed the narrative with regards to our own president, who's been taking some heat for supporting Israel, and all of a sudden everybody in the country, according to the polling you told us about before we went on the air, is now solidly in Israel's corner. We have to hope that Israel accepts what happened last night and claims it as a victory because of how well their defensive capabilities were. And like I said, I'm concerned that the hardliners are going to push for escalation in Israel, and that could lead to a general regional war. And the Middle East is a tinderbox, guys. It always has been, and it's not getting any better.
Yeah, and I'll say this polling I saw, when you combine two numbers, and I wish I had it in front of me, it was like 67%, you know, are kind of supporting the Israel position, and to some extent, of that roughly 33% that's left, you know, you've got some kind of like, I don't know. So those people aren't against, but there is probably a certain percentage of that 33 that are not.
but 67% in today's America is a pretty high number, because then you know at that point you have the support of at least some of the people on both sides of the aisle, and probably a decent number of independents. Well, let's move on to the topic we had planned to lead off with, and that would be, it's kind of a dual topic, because one thing constituted another thing to happen. And the first thing was is the Arizona Supreme Court ruled on a 1864 abortion law, and honestly, I'm not versed enough to know what medical procedures like that would look like in 1864. Also, I'm not versed enough to understand how a territory, because Arizona was one of the final territories to become a state after 1900, how territorial law then carries over to even be possible to become state law over 150 years later. But nevertheless, the Supreme Court of Arizona ruled that this law outlawing abortions, and I don't know if in 1864 we talked about, you know, number of weeks, or if we talked about certain medical things that we have science on now, or, you know, life of the mother, or, you know, different criminal things like rape or incest. But all this is in here, and they've ruled that pretty much women's right to choose in Arizona for the time being is illegal, is no more. Catherine, you probably followed this a little closer than the rest of us. Tell us what you know about the Arizona ruling.
Well, it's really interesting when you dig a little deeper into the laws in the mid-1800s around abortion. Abortion was generally quite common in the 1800s and before. It was dangerous because there wasn't the same kind of procedures that we have, but it was common. It was done both surgically and through tonics and other kinds of, like, medicines. And it was considered it was common up until quickening. They couldn't really determine how far along a woman was until quickening, which is when the fetus begins to move. But it wasn't uncommon. And the reason for these laws was that physicians, doctors, were being undercut by other kinds of, like, semi-professionals who were providing these services. There were no, like, laws around who could do it. And so these laws, there were in a number of states. It's interesting, your point about the territories. I don't know how that's an interesting point. But they were not meant to be restrictive to women. They were meant to, I mean, remember, women couldn't even vote or own land or anything back then. They were really meant to protect women from from practitioners who may not be as well educated or as well practiced as doctors. There were exceptions for the life of the mother. So it's just interesting that those were the law, and there was very little religious consternation around abortion back then. Nobody cared about it. Everybody just knew it was common. There ultimately, because abortion became so common, there was concern about the birth rate, that white women weren't having as many children as they wanted them to. It was really all about white women. And that was another reason for the law. But it was primarily to protect women from, you know, unscrupulous practitioners.
Yeah, I've learned it just through other means, I guess a reading curriculum I one time taught, that a lot of times before medicine really developed, barbers were practitioners of a lot of our medicine, things that we would go to a doctor, particularly a dermatologist for today, was the purview of a hairdresser back then. So with no special medical training at, you know, cosmetology school included. Tim, just kind of your initial thoughts on, you know, what the Arizona Supreme Court did, reinstituting a law that, while if it were newer, it would be looked at one way, but something that was predated their statehood by roughly 50, almost 50 years.
Yeah, let me throw one thing in. You were talking about these practitioners during that time. I think my personal favorite, wouldn't it have been great to get Doc Holliday, who was a cold-blooded killer and a gambler, to also be your dentist? Would that have been great for the family? But anyway, because that's what he did. Anyway, this ban was on about everything. They didn't even have exceptions for rape or incest in it, and it was, you mentioned, it was enacted in 1864 by a ruling body of 27 men in a territory 48 years before Arizona was a state. And now it's just stunning, I think, that the Arizona Supreme Court determined that this law can be enforced now. We'll get into what the Republicans are the two-step they're trying to do, because that's really the funny part of all of this, ain't it, Catherine?
It's not funny, but it's curious.
Maybe comical's a better word, because the very Republicans, including Carrie Lake, who just recently applauded the Dobbs decision, now are doing reversals on this, saying, oh, no, we can't do this and that and the other, because they know it's an election year, and they're concerned about this election, aren't they, David?
Yeah, we got so many facets to take this in, but let's do stay in Arizona. And since you mentioned Carrie Lake, that's applicable. It looks like that they are going to be able to put yet another ballot initiative on the ballot, and I guess from what I understand, Arizona state law, this referendum would be binding, and so they're going to put this on the November ballot. And not only would this be on the November ballot for people to have their say for the, you know, women of Arizona in this case, but also it's going to be with the presidential election. And obviously Arizona is one of the tightest. They're in that group of six or seven, but honestly they're in that Sun Belt three that includes, well, actually maybe four now, that includes Nevada, us, and Georgia, and North Carolina. And they also have a Senate seat. So, Catherine, looking at the referendum, looking at Arizona itself, how do you think this will impact what happens in November there?
Well, I think it's going to be really interesting to see how everybody messages around this. Like former President Trump is like, oh, whoa, you guys gone too far, you know, blah, 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 and Carrie Lake and all these people. But it's going to be interesting to see how Biden messages around it, President Biden, and any outside groups that work on it. Like, I'm sure it's going to be a very big part of advertising, and I think that's going to I think the women the voters of Arizona are going to have to learn a lot about what's going on, because it's so confusing.
Yeah,
but I
think
it bodes well for the Democrats, honestly.
Yeah, I think that it helps, obviously, in that very critical state. And I'm getting the sense that Arizona, maybe one thing that is moving their leftward trend, is more social issues than economic issues. That's a place where they are, you know, seeing themselves growing and want to be more cosmopolitan. Yeah. They're not so interested in the economic side. I mean, they probably are, a lot of those folks, but it's more of that. What do you think, Tim?
Well, because of the severity of this particular law, that they ruled can be enacted as soon as it gets through its legal hula hoops in a couple of weeks. I saw Piers Morgan the other night. He was on Bill Maher, and he said simply because of this one issue, Arizona, which was a state leaning toward Trump, is now suddenly a toss-up. We saw the vice president head out there this weekend. And Kerry Lake, as a result of this ruling, is directly behind the eight. She is now trying to play catch-up in her Senate race. So this decision puts the state heavily into play in the presidential race. I'd say it goes from lean Republican to toss-up overnight. And as you mentioned, trending left. The comical part is watching Republicans trying to do the two-step on this and have it both ways. And you know what? The voters aren't having any of it. We've talked about this before, guys, in these special elections. And now we're seeing it happen in real time in the state of Arizona.
Yeah, and we'll get back into this because there's more to this conversation. But right now we want to welcome on our guest for about the third time on the show, Millen Seem. Welcome back, Millen.
Hello, hello, hello. It's great to be back. How are y'all doing?
I'm doing well. Millen, we've had you on when you were, I guess, not really a high school student, but in that period between high school and college, you were working for one of the top Substacks around Slow and Boring. And then we touched in again with you when you were at Yale University. You still may be, because obviously you were already publishing stuff there. But tell us right off, what are you up to these days?
Oh, well, where do I start? So still at Yale, still at school, wrapping up sophomore year. And now I did a little stint at Decision Desk HQ. If y'all need election results on election night, they do really great work, faster than the AP. Now I'm working at Blueprint. We are a Democratic group seeking to figure out what President Biden needs to say, what Democrats can say, what's the most popular things for the election. The goal is to beat Trump and his MAGA Republicans. We're there to help figure out how that can be done.
Yes. I'm going to ask you a little bit more about Blueprint, but I want to tell you there used to be a commercial that was advertised in, like, Comcast Internet. And this man sat down and he goes, I'm done. I finished the Internet. Millen, at this rate, you're going to be, like, 35 years old. You're going to be done. I've worked for every mover and shaker in the political media world.
Maybe. I mean, I got a couple under the belt. We'll see what the future holds.
Yes. What a resume you've built. I barely had a report card at the time. You have a resume. Well, let's talk about Blueprint Strategies. It's called Blueprint Strategies 2024, so that sounds really fresh and new. Kind of give us their history and what they're about.
Right. So it's relatively new. It's a Democratic public opinion research initiative. The goal, what we do is descriptive, not prescriptive. So our job, we're not a policy shop. We don't pretend that we're, you know, our specialty isn't figuring out what policy would be the most effective or what the dollars and cents impacts of a particular spending plan would be. Our job is to figure out what's popular and what's not. And when that's something progressive, such as taking on Big Pharma to get prices down for our seniors, we'll help that. When that's a little bit more moderate, when a more moderate proposal would be more popular, for example, on immigration and energy, we're going to say that. Our job isn't to figure out what solutions are the best. That's not our specialty. Our job is to figure out what's popular, what messages that Biden is saying are successful, what maybe aren't hitting as hard.
Yes. Well, we're all going to ask you about different issues and different things on the site about research, but I'm going to ask you about one before I pass it to Catherine, then Tim. And that first one is the number one issue in most polls for Republicans, conservative voters, and maybe that's because they've been fed that through Fox News and other media sources, but immigration and the border. What is Blueprint Strategies and yourself finding on the border?
Right. So, yeah, we're definitely seeing that it's people's concern. It's a big concern for a lot of folks. And a lot of people see themselves as maybe to the left of their perception of Biden. Now, I say perception because the recurring thing we find is that people – where people describe themselves is closer to where Biden's actual positions are than voters may think in the polls. But there's a perception that Biden is more left-wing, is more progressive than some of his policies actually are. But we are seeing, you know, the public is in a pretty, based on what the research we've done, public is in a fairly conservative mood on immigration. I think the poll we had out recently was on the border deal, the border deal that fell through. You know, there was pretty good support for cracking down on illegal immigration, for you know, restricting the asylum process or narrowing the scope of it. You know, that's something where you got to meet the voters where they are.
Yes, we've had other folks come on and talk about the border, talk about immigration, talk about employment related to this. I would be interested to see, and I don't know if y'all have done something like this or have batted this idea around, taking some of these conservative voters and saying, okay, we're going to do it, you know, in this, you know, exercise, we're going to do it your way. We're going to shut down all immigration or very little immigration. Okay, this means our population shrinks. This means we really don't have a lot of people to do a lot of jobs, and we're already seeing the effects of that. That means that we don't have a lot of younger taxpayers to fund Social Security and Medicare. So that means those programs are going to really be have to be redone because we don't have these younger workers now because we're just not replacing, you know, people already living here at a fast enough rate. What's your solution? If you said, look, you can have it your way, this will create new problems, what do you do about them? What do you think there was, you know, a project like that would look like?
Right. I mean, it would – so – candidly, that's not something we've looked at so far. It could be an area to look at in the future. I think it would depend in large part on how the question was worded, but I could definitely see the case for that being persuasive, you know, letting people know, hey, there's a trade-off here. You know, I know something the Biden campaign is doing, it's a bit that Milo Bosnat has been pushing, is pointing out to people that, hey, that 10% tariff proposal, tariff's just a fancy economics word for tax on imports. You know, if you're a grocery store owner and all the bananas you're shipping in, they're 10% more expensive, what are you going to do? It's not rocket science. You're going to pass that cost on to the consumer. And I know that's something the campaign, you see them talking about more and more, that Trump's agenda, you know, yeah, people are upset about prices. I'm not happy that gas is, you know, still $3.50. I remember when it was under $3. But, I try to get people to think, even in my own personal life, when I talk to friends I know who are on the fence, I try to get them to think through, like, hey, walk through the effects of these policy proposals that Trump's putting out there. Is that going to make things more expensive or less? Is it going to make the problem better or worse?
Yes. Well, I'm going to pass it along to Catherine, who will pass it along to Tim for more policy questions about y'all's work at Blueprint 2024. Catherine?
Hey, thanks for being on the show tonight. Congratulations on your new gig.
Thank you.
I was really intrigued by one of the postings on the Blueprint site about the deficit. I thought it was really interesting that so many of your respondents are so concerned about the deficit, and I just find it really interesting that people are, like, we always hear people are concerned about pharmaceutical prices or education or immigration or, of course, health care. But deficit spending was a little bit of a surprise to me. Do you have any – I mean, do you think it's just because the economy has been kind of volatile? It's, obviously, we all know it's getting better, but do you think it's because it's been volatile for the – and also, you know, COVID – all that.
Right.
Do you think that's part of it, or
I think that's definitely a factor. You know, if y'all are old enough to remember, I'm not. But do you remember that 92 debate with Bill Clinton and Bush Sr., where a female undecided voter asks, you know, what would you guys do about the deficit? And Bush gives a very smart undergraduate answer, which is, you know, very technical, focuses on interest rates, crowding out private investment. And Bill Clinton, you know, intuits that the woman is really asking, hey, do you empathize with the concerns, the financial concerns of folks like me? And he's like, hey, you know, when someone gets laid off in my state, likely I know them, right? And there's kind of that conventional wisdom that comes from that, that voters don't actually understand the deficit the way, you know, folks who understand macroeconomics do. Voters are just using the deficit as kind of a proxy to signal concern or worry about the economy. And I think partly that might be a factor, right? Like, you know, you hear the deficit on the news, you hear the word national debt is 30-whatever trillion, you think, shoot, that's really bad. But partly in these results, we are seeing that voters, you know, they don't have as good of a handle on economics as a macroeconomist, but they got a pretty decent handle. In our survey, we found that large majorities of voters say that the deficit will affect interest rates, will affect taxes, will affect the prices of goods and services, will affect the level of private investment. These are things that they teach us in intro macro. These are the things literally in this unit that we're in right now in class that we're covering. So there is, to some extent, voters are, you know, correctly perceiving that, look, prices are up. We spent a lot of money on COVID relief, you know. I was talking to Larry Summers the other day about some, he's very strongly saying, like, you know, we spent too much. If people had run the numbers better, they would have seen that this would push inflation up. You know, a lot of people see that spending and think, hey, maybe that's the reason why the prices are higher than I'd like.
Yeah, but, I mean, isn't that sort of, I mean, we always have to be conscious of, you know, how we're spending. I'm sure that we overspent during COVID, but really, that's when you need to spend the money, right? When you have an emergency,
right.
When you have crisis in the country, that's the reason that we don't have we don't require, balanced budget, because we need to have that extra ability to spend in the hard times, so that, or in the tricky times, whether it's war, pandemic, FEMA emergency, whatever, you know. So I wonder sometimes. My father was an economist, and he was not in favor of a balanced budget. So I often wonder if people under. Because you always hear people say, well, I balance my, you know, my budget at home.
Oh, yeah.
Like their checkbook is the same as the, you know, national.
I
think it's interesting that it's like a, I can't remember exactly how you said it, but it is sort of a, just a way of expressing concern about the economy in general.
Right.
So I think that's really interesting.
Yeah,
but,
look, I'm 100% with you on the benefits of spending money during the COVID crisis, during recessions. And, you know, the way a smart guy put it to me was, you know, the trade-off with COVID is there's going to be some amount of economic pain with the global pandemic. Either we have a Great Depression or we go big on stimulus and we risk inflation. And inflation is the better option. But unfortunately, you know, it's hard for people to viscerally feel the counterfactual, right? The point of the counterfactual is that it didn't happen. So you can tell people, hey, you know, it would have been worse if we did the other thing. And you'd be perfectly correct. But people, you know, they're not living through the other thing because we didn't do it, because we avoided the worst outcome.
Right, exactly. That's why they're supposed to trust us, not us, but our government. And that's why they don't, because they feel like they're doing something wrong. Anyway. I just found that very interesting, and thank you for, like, further exploring it with me. And now I'm going to turn it over to Tim. He's got a whole bunch of questions for you.
Sure.
Thank you.
Good evening, Mr. Singh, and welcome back to the Kudzu Vine.
Yes, sir.
Well, it's rumored we have an election this year. I'm sure that
we
has
hope.
A lot to do with why your organization is in business. During the primary season, 21% of Republican primary voters voted for Nikki Haley. And that was, you know, against a fella who you know, the conventional wisdom says lock, stock, and barrel has control of the Republican Party, but 21% opposition is, you know, it's pretty significant. And so what about Nikki Haley voters now? Any idea what they might do in the general election or how Democrats could get them to do what we'd like them to do?
Oh, yeah. So I got a couple, right? So the first thing is, yeah, there are a lot of Nikki Haley voters, and they're a group that's absolutely up for grabs. The results we've seen have found, A, just looking at the numbers, right, the number of Haley voters from the primary are more numerous than the winning margin for Biden in 2020 in four key states, New Hampshire, Michigan, North Carolina, and Georgia, where y'all are at. So that's a big opportunity for Biden there, right? The campaign is definitely making a play for them. We've seen Trump say on his Truth Social, you know, oh, any Nikki Haley supporters, we don't want them, we don't need them. You know, when she dropped out, we saw Biden start putting out messages saying, hey, Haley voters, there's a home for you in this campaign. If you're still against Trump, you know, we got common cause. You know, where we did some testing, we did a word association game sort of thing, right, where we asked people to pick words that they felt described Biden, described Trump. You know, Haley voters were much more positive on Biden than the general electorate. They were a lot more likely to use certain words. I think honorable was one of them. That's helpful, right? Now, the possible hedge against that is that, as you know, I'm sure some of y'all know, I was supposed to do this. I was out of town on election day, so I forgot to do it. But I meant to switch my party registration to independent and vote in the Republican primary in Connecticut, right? There are a bunch of people I know, you know, I'm sure you've seen, it's been in the media, basically Democrats who wanted to cast a protest vote against Trump, do what they can to try to stop Trump or signal their lack of support. Now, to the extent that some of these Haley voters, a non-trivial number probably, are basically Democrats who crossed the aisle this one time, you know, those are people that Biden already has. But certainly there's some on the Haley voters who are probably folks who went for Romney, you know, probably folks who went for McCain, folks who even went for Trump the first time or maybe even the second time, but thought, you know what, you know, now I just can't do it a third time, right? Like one of my good friends at school, he's typically, you know, he's a typically conservative fellow, right? He said straightforwardly, you know, I think Republicans are better in economics. If I was old enough to vote in 2020, I would have voted for Trump. But he's told me multiple times that January 6th stuff is disqualifying. He's like, you know, even if I don't love Biden, I'm going to vote for him this year because I just can't vote for a guy who tried to overturn the election. Like, so there are these people out there that are definitely winnable. And a lot of Biden's strongest issues with Haley voters in our polling are democracy, abortion rights, Social Security, and Medicare. These are mostly the same as his best issues with the overall electorate. So there's not really a huge trade-off, in my view, between shoring up the base, shoring up, you know, people who switched from Biden last time or thinking about voting for Trump this time, and pulling in some of these moderate Republicans who are looking at Trump and saying, I just can't get by with that.
So what about the added little thing of these third-party candidacies of RFK Jr., Cornel West, and Jill Stein? Cumulatively, will they pull enough support to be able to swing the presidential election one way or the other?
I mean, it's certainly possible, right? I think out of all three of those candidates, I think RFK is the most prominent. You know, he has a lot of name recognition on account of being, you know, a bit of a nepo baby, to use a Lord
Jenny
term.
Can I interrupt just for a second?
Yeah.
Let's be sure to call him RFK Jr.
Yeah. Yeah, no problem. Sorry. So Jr., Bobby Jr., he's polling the highest out of all these third-party candidates. He's got a lot of name recognition. It's certainly possible, right? I think in polls right now, from what we've seen, from what I've seen, it seems like he's pulling from both sides, from both Democrats and Republicans, but a bit more from Democrats. I know a buddy of mine who's personally told me, he's like, you know, I can't really vote for Biden. He doesn't like Biden, you know, but he's like, you know what, I'll probably vote for RFK in the general. So it's definitely a possibility. I think, well, you know, RFK's campaign itself thinks it could play spoiler. I don't know if y'all seen the clip, but there's his, I think, New York State director who got caught on camera saying, like, we're in this race to throw the election to Trump because we want to beat Biden. You know, a lot of the same donors who are giving to Trump are giving to Bobby Kennedy Jr. because, again, they want him to play spoiler. It's definitely a possibility. It's something, from what I've seen, the campaign is not taking lightly. They're taking it seriously as it should be. And I think it's key to let people know, you know, put that message out there. Look, dude's not going to win, but he's going to – he could swing the election to this other guy. So you might think you're voting for RFK Jr., but actually, you know, your vote's really helping Trump. And if you don't want Trump, there's one person you should vote for, and his name is Joe Biden.
Hmm. So I'm going – my final question is about Joe Biden. Is the age of the president the top criticism of him by your poll respondents?
Yeah, the answer is yes. The top negative words or concerns people have about Biden when we do these polls, I think this was the contrast messaging poll on the website. That's what it's listed under. Top concerns in order among the overall electorate are age, inflation, and immigration. I forget the order of the last two, but age is consistently the top concern. It's the top concern you hear from voters. You know, you hear it in the media a lot. It is a concern for folks. But what Biden says and what I think is correct is, look, this election is not about who's the optimal candidate, who's the ideal candidate. It's not about comparing candidates to the almighty. It's about comparing them to the alternative, whose ideas are newer, whose ideas are moving us forward. We got one candidate who's going on camera saying, I ended Roe v. Wade. I terminated it, and I was proud to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And we got one candidate who's saying, if I'm reelected with the Democratic majority in Congress, the Democratic majority in the Senate, I will codify Roe v. Wade, and I will guarantee women's right to choose nationwide. We got one candidate who's talking about, let's slap a 10% tax. It's a tax. You know, they can call it a tariff. It's a tax. I studied this stuff. I know it's a tax on all imports to make your prices go higher. And we got one candidate saying, look, I'm going to take on Big Pharma. I'm going to take on these greedy corporations. I'm going to shore up our agricultural supply chains to get our prices lower. We got one candidate who's going to protect Social Security, who's going to protect Medicare, who's going to protect the Affordable Care Act. We got one candidate who will cut all of those to give a tax break to his same rich buddies that he did the last time. And that's at the end of the day, these guys are, neither of them are spring chickens, right? They're both like pushing 80.
Right.
It's about who has the better ideas.
All right. Well, Mr. Singh, we appreciate you having you on again. I know we're going to see you again probably before the election because you're going to be doing a lot of stuff this year. And with that, I'm going to throw it back to David for some more questions. David?
Yes, I just had a follow-up to, you know, what Tim asked about Joe Biden's age, and that would be, what are voters saying about Donald Trump's age? Because if, you know, if this were Ron DeSantis or Nikki Haley or Vivek Ramaswamy, there would be a contrast there. But this is Donald Trump,
right,
who's slightly younger, but then in a physical condition way, maybe even have an older physical age.
Right. So we haven't seen much of this in our polling, I don't think, off the top of my head. But I've seen in, for example, the New York Times polls, consistently voters are less concerned about Trump's age than Biden's. And there are a couple possible reasons. One is Biden's currently 81, if I remember correctly. Trump is, I think, 78. You know, maybe that 80-year-old line is significant for voters in some way, right? Second, you know, it might be some sort of just perception, right? The media has gone after Biden, has, you know, focused on the age thing since he came in office. You know, whereas with Trump, when he was president, the age thing was not as much of a concern. It was more about his stability. And third, I think my personal theory is that, you know, Trump's been in the spotlight for, like, what, like 8 years now? Christ. But, like, he's been in the spotlight so long, been saying erratic stuff, crazy stuff, you know, just out-of-pocket stuff for so long that that's just typical, right? When Trump goes on TV and says, I'm being indicted for you, the black population, like, that's just another day, right? It's not a scandal. It's oh, yeah, we'd expect that from him, right? Whereas with Biden, it's like, he's seen as, you know, a normal guy, and so maybe people perceive things differently. Also, you know, guy has a stutter. He's always stuttered. He's always done gaffes. But most people, for most of his career, he wasn't very prominent. You know, he was a senator from a small state. You know, people like me knew about him, but normal people who, like, spend a normal amount of time paying attention to this stuff didn't. He was VP. You know, obviously, Barack Obama was the star. He captured the spotlight. People weren't paying attention to Joe. And maybe, you know, that you know, personally – believe that it's mostly the stutter, and like I trust based on the reports I've read, some folks I know who have spoken to him that he's all there mentally. But, you know, I can understand the perception on TV. Nonetheless, I think it comes down to what are these – like, it's not about the performative aspects, right? You know, Trump, he's funny. Trump's a funny guy. But does he have good ideas? No. He's, you know, he might make you laugh, but is he going to make your pockets fatter or thinner? It comes down to that question. Is he going to protect your rights or take them away?
Yeah, I could think he'd come down to a lot of questions. I will say that I saw President Biden with my own eyes, probably less than 50 feet away, no wires attached. He seemed doing very, very well for a gentleman his age, speaking.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he spoke for a while, and so, you know, I think he's passing that test more and more. Obviously, November's a long way away, and once again, he's not having to be compared to the almighty, or in this case, like a 45-year-old person in the prime of professional
right.
life, but a 77-year-old that has some pretty unhealthy habits.
Oh, and I will say, this is an anecdote y'all will like. I've seen – this is not from Blueprint. This is some other testing that I've seen. Testing of Democratic ads, how they perform relative to the average Democratic ad. The best performing Democratic ads are, first, testimonials of women talking about their experiences with abortion and reproductive rights, and second, Joe Biden talking to camera. Those are the best performing ads. So when we put Joe out there, when people see that he's all there, that he's still got it, that moves them a non-trivial amount. So I say, you know, trust the plan. That these guys in the campaign, they're guys who get paid way more than I do, who are way smarter than me. They got a vision for this.
Yeah, I actually told somebody that day that it was with the campaign. I mean, maybe multiple rungs down, because I had seen a YouTube ad right before that. I said, y'all ought to run those all the time. Those little 5-second ads where he's talking to the camera, because it will get in people's minds that they're seeing these shorts. You know, you can let them play and they might be 15 seconds, 30 seconds, but people will see them over and over every time they start a YouTube video, and they're going, yeah, I hear him all the time talking. He's doing great. And that would get in the, you know, folks' minds. And it's simple, and YouTube ads are easy to target and far less expensive than, say, the ads they bought for the women's college basketball games last week. I bet they can afford those. Well, let me leave you with this, Millen. We know Blue State – or Blue – Blueprint's working on all kind of stuff. Tell us some things that we may be seeing between now and, say, the end of the summer, maybe.
Oh, unfortunately, I'm not at liberty to disclose. I just
say
to all your listeners, keep an eye on the website, keep an eye on the Twitter account. If I could, I would, but keep an eye.
Oh, I understand.
Keep an eye. We'll have some.
No.
Don't worry.
Yeah, well, then leave our listeners with that. If they want to keep an eye out, where do they see you, both the site and social media?
Right. So the website is Blueprint. That's Blueprint, like, you know, the word for an architectural plan. Blueprint2024.com. On Twitter, it's Blueprint_2024. That's the handle. You can also find Evan Ross Smith and Alyssa Cass on a lot more media appearances than I do. They're really bright people, really great folks. That's where you can find us.
Well, when it comes to Blueprint 2024, you're going to be our guy. Between now and election 2024.
Yeah, whenever y'all want me to come on, I'm happy to.
All right. Well, we're going to wait till the summer because we want you to finish strong there at Yale, because from what we've heard, it's just a little bit difficult. It's a place of higher learning. But once again, thank you for coming on the show tonight.
Yeah. Thank you all for having me.
Thank you, sir.
Have a good night, folks. Good night.
You too. All right. Millen Singh of Blueprint 2024 and Yale University. I just love it how he says, yeah, I was talking to Larry Summers the other day about economics, a guy that I believe worked for both the Clinton and Obama administrations, one of the foremost political economists around. And he's just like, you know, we talked on the show tonight, that kind of casual thing. Well, let's get back into our discussion about the Republicans and abortion. And we talked about Arizona, and I do think this is like much like the Alabama ruling. This is much like what happened with the young lady, I believe, that was in Ohio that they had to take across state lines because she was, I mean, a preteen.
and to get medical services. And these stories horrify people across the country, not just in that one state. And I think this Arizona ruling is just going to be another thing there where it bleeds across the country, where Donald Trump, I think, knows that this is bad policy. It's not popular policy. Therefore, it's bad for him, which is what he weighs things on. How will it impact him? And so now let's get into that. Donald Trump has taken, I guess, position 463 on abortion in his public life. Catherine, what's your thoughts
on Donald Trump? He's just desperate. He's desperate like the rest of the Republicans. They recognize that it's a losing battle to try to keep these laws on the books or, you know, bring new laws. That they recognize it, but they also have a, you know, anti-abortion base that they can't go against. So they're really between a rock and a hard place, and they don't have the knowledge or they don't have the knowledge to try to explain the intricacies of these laws and the medical procedures. So they're, you know, they're just grasping at straws. And I don't think it's going to bode well for them come November.
Yes. Tim, Donald Trump has been teasing a position on abortion for really a few weeks now, I guess we'd say. He finally felt compelled after the Arizona ruling, it being such a swing state, it being, I think, with the year of the initial law, it just really looked bad. So he comes out with this policy that's not really with a majority of the American people, but it's not really with the majority of Republican voters either. It's somewhere in the middle. What's your thoughts on, you know, the move Donald Trump took?
Catherine mentioned the number of positions he's taken. I remember seeing him on Howard Stern's show about 25 years ago, and in the last 25 years, I think he has literally taken every position from strongly pro-choice to all the way to taking credit for ending Roe v. Wade, along with everything in between that you can think of. Now he's gambling on this combination of pushing a 15-week ban nationwide and leaving the rest up to the states. That's not going to work. None of this nonsense is just coming up with where they're saying, let's meet in the middle and let's moderate our position. It's not going to work. The whole right wing does not understand that people view all of this as rights taken away from them, and they don't like it. They don't want it. And they're telling Trump and everybody else that in these special elections and stuff. And it's like it's just going right by them. They could really, really reap a whirlwind in November, especially in statewide and congressional elections. If they don't come up with some sort of consensus on what they're, you know, what they need to say to the American people about this, they're going to lose a lot of races that they should want, just like they did in 2022. Don't this remind you of 2022 all over?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's keeping it in the news. And Catherine, I kind of have a little strange for three Democrats to speculate about, but whereas he's going to lose votes from the center on this issue, particularly from women that see this as a issue worth voting on, if he takes this position where he's like, well, abortion rights could be legal in this way, in this way, at this time, could he possibly get some voters that are single-issue, pro-life voters to then just not vote for him, leave the presidential line blank? And I say that at this point because there's really no alternative unless RFK Jr. becomes that. Who knows? But could he possibly lose some votes from his right flank on this?
Well, that's what I think they're concerned about. I think they're concerned. That's what I was sort of alluding to, is that they know that this is an important issue to the majority of American voters. But they have this small sliver of, like you said, single-issue voters who, I mean, I said this from the very beginning when Dobbs was decided. I was like, well, they just lost a big chunk of voters because those single-issue voters, they're like, oh, well, we turned over Roe v. Wade, so now we don't have to vote anymore. We don't have to give him any money. And so, yes, I think that if they see Trump and other Republicans waffling on abortion, they could just stay home. I don't think they'd vote for anybody else unless RFK Jr. did something crazy, but I don't think that's going to happen. Yeah.
Well, I mean, he made some statements that were kind of against IVF, and it just seems like, you know, he's taken so many weird turns, he's very unpredictable at this point.
Yeah, but I don't think a single-issue voter who votes particularly, especially anti-abortion, is ever going to trust a Kennedy.
Maybe so.
That's a good point.
Well,
yeah.
Well, Tim, let me talk about something else. He was criticized by two people after that statement, probably more than two, but two that I'm going to talk about. One was Lindsey Graham, and, of course, Lindsey Graham will make up with him in half a week. But the other was a gentleman that he, maybe not directly, but kind of indirectly, supported people that were or advocated people to hang him, Mike Pence, his former vice president. And Mike Pence, you know, is somebody that actually this is an important issue to him. A lot of the people that are Mike Pence-type Republicans, this is a big issue to him. Could Mike Pence see this, A, or actually really ABC, A, as a way to stay in the spotlight if he wants to, B, to actually stand up for an issue he personally cares about and give voters a place to, you know, put their support if this is truly an issue they want to, you know, from a conception to the end of the pregnancy, any reason, you know, we're abandoning abortion, and then see if he does want to stop Donald Trump from being president because of the way Donald Trump conducts himself, and he is a threat to true democracy, which, you know, seemingly Mike Pence has more respect for the democratic institutions of our government than Donald Trump. He could be the person for those folks to drop their support if he could somehow get on enough states. I don't even know if he could at this point. But that would be a reason for him to run or support some kind of write-in candidates, anything to hurt Donald Trump to where, you know, he has an impact. Could you see Mike Pence doing that?
Well, no, I don't see Mike Pence jumping out there and running right now. You got to go out and raise money and do things that, of course, he hasn't done, so he's not going to do that. I can see him speaking in some places where, you know, and he is going to mention Donald Trump, I think, waffling on abortion. But he's going to have to sort of walk a tightrope because it isn't just Trump on the ballot this year. The whole Republican Party is on the ballot. None of them have been able to come up with, you know, a reasonable explanation to the American people of what they're even trying to do or want to do. are a reasonable explanation to the American people as to why they wanted Roe v. Wade overturned anyway, when the American people did not want that. And at the same time, you got to keep the hardliners in line to vote for the other Republican candidates down ballot. If they're not going to vote for Donald Trump, wouldn't they be less likely to vote for, say, their congressional candidate? Are we talking about people that would be angry at Trump and sit at home? Because if they sit at home, they don't vote for anybody. So I don't know exactly if Pence could hurt Trump that badly on this particular issue. I mean, Pence's pro-life credentials are safe. I mean, he stands where he stands, and everybody knows where he stands. But Trump has gotten along, David, for so long by not standing for much of anything that you wonder if all this yapping he's doing about abortion is even going to affect him one way or the other, even though it might affect a lot of Republicans down ballot a lot worse, right?
Yeah, it's kind of like the adage, if you don't stand for anything, you'll fall for everything. And they've definitely fallen for this con artist who is, I mean, if this is a critical issue, and it is to seemingly many evangelical voters, they're just not getting what they got from politicians in the past. So I think we should demand somebody that supports their position.
David, if these evangelical Christians haven't already abandoned Trump over the Access Hollywood tape and the Stormy Daniels scandal and just all this crazy stuff he's done, I don't think they'll abandon him over this issue either.
No, and they're once again, they're not standing for anything when it comes to politics. Well, I want to thank again Millen Singh for coming on the show and tell you about next week's show. Dante Cheney of the American Communities Project and NBC News has agreed to come back on because the American Communities Project, it just keeps rolling. It's gotten some different counties, some different places around the country it's looking at. Sadly, one of them is no longer Tim's home county of Chattooga County, Georgia, but he's got new places, so we'll have Dante on the show next week and ask him all about that work. But until next week, it's been the Cudzie Vine.
Good night, y'all.
Good night, guys.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around